From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. Welcome to The Treatment. For the over 20 years I've been doing this show, I've known Spike Lee for more than that, since She's Gotta Have It in 1986.
That's way back in the way back.
That's way back when you first got started. Finally, I got to get you to sit down here. Of course, your latest film is Black Klansman. I can't thank you enough for doing this, Spike. So good to see you.
Always good to see you, Elvis.
Here's what I got to ask you. You don't do, until maybe like the last 15 years or so, a lot of screenplays that have been written by other people. What is it when you see a screenplay that comes to you from somebody else? What do you look for in that?
Well, I've never had the attitude that I can only direct stuff that I write. So if I read something that's a great story that I feel I could add to it as a director and sometimes a writer, then I'm not hesitant. I have no hesitancy at all.
And what was it you saw in Black Klansman that you think this was something you should do?
Well, it's not what I saw, because Jordan Peele called me up out of the blue because they've been developing this project already. And it was, I think, one of the greatest pitches in the history of studio. Six words. Black man infiltrates Ku Klux Klan. So it was really Jordan's pitch.
As simple as that.
Simple as that. Because I never heard of Ron Storth or his story.
Yeah, I hadn't heard about it either until I heard about this project. And then I ran to your producers at Cannes a couple nights before the film played. And you got a chance to go back to Cannes after not being there for a while. What was that like?
Oh, I mean, I love Cannes. I still think it's the world's greatest film festival. I've had great experiences there. You mentioned She's Gonna Have It. It was there in Cannes, 1986, won the Prix de Jeunesse. Do the Right Thing, you know, several other films too. So I always have a good experience in Cannes. And that was a magical night I'm going to remember for a long time, the world premiere of Black Klansman in Cannes. It was amazing.
It was. And it's funny because it felt like the kind of film that should be playing at Cannes, because it felt like the kind of thing that should be seen around the world, didn't it?
Well, it's made much money internationally, it's domestically.
So, yeah.
So that, I mean, that's a tribute to that. And I'm happy. Because what you see in this film is happening all over the world. The rise of the right. The new election, this guy in Brazil.
What almost happened in France?
Yeah, Salvini in Italy. Brexit. So it's not just, you know, Agent Orange. And I think that's really been the appeal of the film. That what Kevin Wilmot and I, my co-writer, what we did was reconnected the past. This film takes place in the mid-70s. We connected with present day. We made a contemporary period film, which is hard to do.
What do you mean you say contemporary period film?
Well, what I mean by that is that there's a lot of things, you watch the film, a lot of things that are like a bell goes off. You're like, this thing's happening today. You know, it's not just something that you're looking like, well, look at the clothes, look at the belt bombs, look at the afros, you know, that type of stuff. No, when you leave the theater after that coda, Charlottesville, you know, you say, you know, this is the world we live in today.
Yeah, because I think you're talking about is just taking attitudes that basically are as contemporary as they were then.
Yes, I mean, racism, fascism is not new. It comes from the same playbook, and they just, you know, change some words, try to pre it up. America First, the Klan was saying that in the 1920s against immigrants. So all these things are rehashed, made shiny. Well, it's the same thing, though. It's still hate.
And it's also, for you, a chance, gives you a chance to use your sense of film history in this by bringing Birth of a Nation to the movie at the very beginning. Was that something you decided on pretty early?
Oh, no. Gone with the Wind.
Gone with the Wind. But Birth of a Nation plays a part in this, too, though.
Obviously. No, but you said to start with.
Right, I mean, yeah.
The film opens with what is considered one of the greatest shots in the history of cinema. It's a great shot where Scarlett Harris going through the train yard, Civil War, thousands of extras and dummies. if you go slow, you can see something is dummy.
I don't want to look that close, but okay.
But and then we go to our faux segregationist PSA, played by the great
Alec Baldwin.
And then the movie starts.
I mean, what that is a great way to give us a taste of how things haven't changed and how movies have been used as propaganda to promote racism since the very beginning.
And in addition to that, Elvis, I mean, those two films are very personal to me. I had seen clips of Birth of a Nation. It wasn't until my first semester at NYU graduate film school where I saw it, and we were taught about how D.W. Griffith was a cinematic genius. But nothing was discussed about the social impact of that film, how that film gave life, gave rebirth to the Klan. Consequently, directly, black folks got lynched, castrated, and whatnot. That was not talked about.
My guess was going personal already in the conversation.
Going
Spike
in.
Lee. Yeah, that's how it goes. It's Spike Lee. His new film, of course, is Black Klansman. It's the treatment. I guess one of the things that strikes me about this film is you do something that I think you're so good at, and we've talked about this before, is the way you make guys so these tribal groups and the way they talk is kind of this way that they communicate only with each other. And that's interesting that you brought that to both sides of the question.
Mm-hmm. Well, when you're amongst your tribe, you talk one way, and mixed company, you talk another. I mean, I don't care who that is. That's across the board.
But that's something you've been doing since the beginning. We can go back to She's Gotta Have It. I mean, those guys all talk the same. They're these groups of guys who break off and talk the way they talk. That's this thing you do.
I know that's human nature, but, you know, I know that, you know, when white folks get together, you know, it's not all white folks, but, you know, they might be throw around a couple N-words there, and, you know, black folks get together. You know, we talking about them. We might throw in a couple redneck crackers, too.
Maybe a couple.
You know, so it's I understand it. It comes from both sides, you know?
It is, but, I mean, a thing I always associate with you, even in your documentaries, is you have this ear for the power of conversation. Mm-hmm. And it's been the
I
way
I tell people all the time, say what you mean what you say, you know?
Yeah, but it's interesting because I think it's this thing that's specific to you, the way people talk in these groups. And I wonder if that's just something you just kept your ear trained for growing up, if it's something you've been conscious of in the way you make movies, because it's really important. I mean,
I've always been a good listener, and, you know, I love words and phrases. I mean, during the Kwame Ture speech scene, you know, I'm the guy in the backs saying, boom shakalaka. That's me. And then the end is another scene after the chief tells Ron Stewart that the case is over. You know, one of his detective friends goes out the room saying, skullduggery, shenanigans, subterfuge. I love words, you know, words like a boondoggle, a brouhaha, fisticuffs.
We can look at you, just to get ready for this, just watch a bunch of films. It really struck me about how powerful conversation is and how so many of these times you write these people who are convinced of the power of their words. I mean, they're almost preachers in a lot of ways, the way that you write people.
Oh, yes, because I, you know, growing up in Brooklyn, New York, I never believed that sticks and stones will break your bones, words will never hurt. Words hurt. It's not be somebody who hates you. It could be your parent, you know. What could be more hurtful than a parent to tell their young child, you ain't going to be shit? Words hurt. Words hurt. And so that is why we wanted to show with a whole bunch of racial slurs, you know, in this film. Words hurt.
And how comfortable people are with that, too. I mean,
yes, just... also, you know, how they hurt people. Also, they're meant to dehumanize people. I mean, you look at these, you know, John Ford films, you know, what they did to, you know, in combination with John Wayne, savages, and I mean, it's... I mean, the great film is not, in my opinion, has not been made about the genocide of Native Americans in this country. And Hollywood, TV, even stuff before it had a lot to, you know, dehumanize. I mean, Native Americans are almost like invisible now. Relegated to, I'm not going to use the word reservation, I'm going to say relegated to concentration camps. Over-indexing everything, alcohol, high blood pressure, diabetes. I mean, it's you know, it's sad. And what is not being taught, what was not being talked about is that this country, United States of America, was built upon the genocide of Native people and slavery. So we're talking about American history, and that's not where you start. That's not the first chapter, the first page. This country was built upon the genocide. I'm talking about the, forget, this has to be the first sentence in the book. If you're writing a book about true American history, in my opinion.
That's why you're here, for your opinion. Yeah. I guess, though, it seems like if we look at your film, so much of your movies, so much of the stuff you've done has been a response to the kind of stuff you've seen and read and been taught, and asking why this other side of the question hasn't been asked.
Mm-hmm. That's a fair assessment, my brother. Do the Right Thing was a response to the tense racial climate in New York City at the time under Mayor Ed Koch. And a lot of this conflict, historically, especially in New York City, is between Italian-Americans and African-Americans. I think it's because we're so close. You know, it was the same people, but I swear to God, you know. And let's be honest, Sicily ain't that far from Africa. Hannibal was over there. You know, there's a line in Do the Right Thing. My character, Mookie, I'm with Pino, played by the great John Turturro, and I say, your hair is kinkier than mine. And you know what's funny, though? You ever watch that show, Skip Gates' show on...
On genealogy?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and I said, I wrote that in 88. John Turturro and Brian Gumbel are related. It was in the show.
That explains the hair, I guess.
The kink! And that's my brother.
All right, we have a little bit of history lesson.
And then another thing, though.
What? Go.
Another one. I'm related to Brad Pitt.
I'm sorry. It sounded like you said you're related to Brad Pitt.
Yes.
Okay.
Google it.
No, I think my computer will explode. We're going to take a break.
That's not, it's old.
You know what? And it'll still make my computer explode. Don't burn up my machinery.
Can somebody in
no.
the room,
hey,
can
hey,
you
I'm right.
print that out, please?
Spike Lee, I'm right here. Can you print? I'm right here. Spike Lee, I'm right here. We're going to take a break. No more history lesson. We come back with more with Spike Lee as we try to get somebody to make a computer explode by typing in Brad Pitt and Spike Lee, the director and co-writer of the great new film, Black Klansman. It's a treatment. There's more to come, I think. Stay with us.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back. We just found out that we probably all relate to Brad Pitt, including my guest Spike Lee, whose new film, of course, is Black Klansman. I can't sit here and not ask you, as a professor, what do you teach?
Tenured.
Tenured. Forgive my imprecision. Tenured NYU professor, Spike Lee.
Graduate film school.
What do you teach there? What films do you show your students?
Oh, I show a lot. But the sad thing is, sir, is that first class, first semester, I have a list of films, and I films I feel that are essential.
Such as? What's on that list?
A lot of Italian neorealism films, a whole bunch of stuff. And so I go through the list and I ask my students to raise their hand if they've seen them. And these are 30, the graduate film school is 3 years. So these are 30-year students getting ready to do their thesis film. And it's sad that so many of the older classic films, people haven't seen these films.
Why do you think that is? Because there's so much accessibility. Now, when we were coming up, you had to work to go see these movies. I mean, it was kind of a job.
In a lot of ways, it's kind of easy because when we were growing up, though, you had the repertory theaters.
Sure.
To see these films projected.
Sure.
Now you can get, criteria and stuff like that. But I just think there's this thing where it's not just my film students, just across the board, that if something happened before, if a movie, TV show, or book came out before they were born, it's prehistoric, and it's sad to me.
But it's so funny now because you would think that so much of history is based on remakes and knowing what's out there and being able to use that. I mean, basically, you're going through film school. You're learning techniques that other people invented and pioneered, right? Mm-hmm. So why do you think there's so little interest then in going farther back?
I'm not trying to make a blanket statement, but
You're saying
it's
the case
still alarming to me.
Right.
I just think that generationally wise, a son was born, before, whatever it is, a piece of art that existed before they were born, and then they don't care. Much as I think they should.
Yeah. I mean, but that fascinates me because I teach too, and I just sort of find if it goes back more than 5 years, there's no
way. So you agree with me then, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, 100%. And it's shocking, this kind of.
You know what's crazy, though, is that you could say it's a hip hop too. They might like this song, but they don't know where the sample came from. The original. It's a great song, but these.
It's all samples. It's all samples now.
It's samples. You should know, especially a hip hop head, you should know where those samples come from.
But so much of your work is about understanding where you're from. I mean,
I always love history.
That's always been a part of what you do. Your characters at some point in any given film, any of your films, somebody talks about where they're from and how much their past has had an impact on them. I mean, that's key.
Good
to
or
the
bad.
One thing. Yeah, no, absolutely.
Right.
And that's been key to you as a storyteller. Why do you think that seems to have disappeared so much from storytelling now?
Because where you're born, when you're born, impacts your life. I mean, if it just impacts, who you are, it's impact of where you're born and when you're born. That shapes your life. So it's the starting point. It's basic to me. And I'm not making judgment, I went to Morehouse College, and them brothers from Detroit were different.
Why you gotta do this every time?
Here's a funny thing.
Oh, go.
In Morehouse, why are you laughing? In Morehouse, either it's spring break or Christmas break, people would go home, and then they would come back with a dance from where they are. And one year, I forgot it was, these brothers from Detroit came back doing the Errol Flynn. I said, what dance is that? That's Errol Flynn. And all of them went to Cass Tech, too. Everybody from Detroit that came to Morehouse went to Cass Tech. Where'd you go?
I didn't go to Cass Tech. It's a treat. My guest who had to bring up Detroit.
You mean Detroit?
Forgive me again. Detroit. My Morehouse educated friend, Spike Lee, his new film, as he runs me down into a fine powder, is Black Klansman.
I got love for Detroit.
I still think there's a great film.
I also get a shout out to Berry Gordy, I still don't think he's gotten his due.
But this takes me back to what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. This idea for you that history informs character. Mm-hmm. I mean, that it always does. And so often, even in the case of Black Klansmen, where they don't have any right to be proud of themselves, they are. There's this pride in where people come from and what formed them that I think is so interesting. And I do wonder, you talking about it being so important to you, but it's key to what you think of character. People are always talking about who they are and what makes them.
I know you know, people might get upset about this. You know, when I'm meeting somebody first time, my first question is, where are you from? Because for me, I meet a lot of people, and people come up to me in the street. You know, if they catch me at a red light, all right, when this light turns green, I'm out. Because I can't have an hour-long conversation. So it's all for me, where you from is always a shorthand, like, all right, my brain starts going, oh, all right, here, this is who this person is. Now, it may be stereotyping, but I don't have time to think about, you know, we got to get right to it quick. You happen to catch me at a red light, all right, I'll talk to you. When I like is green, it's like peace. And for me, where are you from? And a lot of times, you know, I'm right. You know, the whatever thing that I think of who this person might be, they say, oh, figures. Why? You know, it's just a shorthand for me. Because it's just I'm just reinforcing your point that where you're from, I don't think you can underestimate, you know, the impact it has on who you are.
I don't think you can either, but I think it's as the years have gone by and you've stuck this ethos that people are really informed by who raised them, where they're from, what that history means to them, and that you write people who take such ownership of that. Mm-hmm. It's so specific to you. And even now, I mean, again, when people don't have any right to have any pride about what they are or who they are, they still have that pride. And that kind of pride.
Some people, that's all they got. Ride or die. You know, I'm from Oak Town. South Side, you know, Chicago. Right. South Side, you know, the boogie down Bronx.
Even for you, mm-hmm. since I've known you, one of the first things that's always come across, and I've been out with you a lot of times, we've been in the ball games, we've been all kinds of stuff, mm-hmm. and you engage people because you really, I don't care what you say about the burning past and once the light changes, you do talk to people, you do engage with people.
I try to.
And I just wonder if that becomes part of the way you think as a storyteller, that people surround so often trying to give you their history because they want to connect with you, I think, mm-hmm. really fast. Does that become a way for you to help get across who a character is?
No, it depends on people. Now, not a lot, but there's a certain amount of those people, you know, trying to get me to do a movie. So that's
well, a lot of
those
that.
Are very short commercials, but I mean, very, very short conversations.
And commercials for their project.
True. But I'm fascinated by people, you know, what makes them tick. Another thing, which you might see, you've probably seen in my films, that a key thing is, in the character of my film, Elvis, the decisions people make and the ramifications of those decisions. Because in life, you know, you have choices. And we all know people who came to that crossroad, that fork in the road, they made the wrong decision. They will never recover from that the rest of their life. So I love that, you know, where why did that person make that decision?
Yeah, and it's often people making decisions that really sort of tear them. We could look at Ron Stallworth as being that guy. You know, where do his loyalties lie? Do they lie with the job or with his people? I mean, that's something that ends up being this thing too for
and,
you.
And it's dramatic too, because people are in turmoil. I mean, did you see Vice?
Yeah.
I like that film. And you know, I'm not a Dick Cheney fan. And last night.
I don't think anybody who made Vice is a Dick Cheney fan, but okay.
And last night.
At the Golden Globes, you're the Golden Globes.
Christian Bale's speech. He said, I want to thank Satan. I was dying laughing. Because that man is what he did. Mothers and daughters don't have. Father's parents don't have children because that man today. That weapons of mass destruction, that was one of the biggest hoaxes ever. And then the way they set up brother Colin Powell, played by Tyler Perry. My brother, I gave a big hug yet last night.
You gave Tyler Perry
a
hug?
Yeah, we're tight. We're good.
Okay.
No, we've been good.
Okay.
Been good. So, that thing was fake. people are no longer here because of a lie. There were no, F that, we had false information. That's BS. That was some shenanigans.
Skullduggery.
Skullduggery. Subterfuge.
Boondoggle. No, no, but to, also to write about people who understand the power of language.
Oh, yeah. They know.
Yeah, I mean, that's something that you're attracted to, too, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, especially like Bud Schulberg.
Bud Schulberg, sure.
A Face in the Crowd.
Yeah.
That film was came out in 57. Bud had, I mean, he predicted Viagra. He predicted the power of television.
The Fox Network. I mean, all these things we think about now, you can see it in Face in the Crowd. Face in the Crowd.
Face in the Crowd, directed by Emily Kazan. Vida Jex, what you doing to me? Which is really Viagra.
Oh, absolutely. But are these the kind of films you show your students?
Oh, yeah. We definitely see. Here's some definites we see. We saw Face in the Crowd this semester. We saw On the Waterfront, both by Kazan, Schulberg.
Right.
We saw Pixote. When Bertolucci died, we show the Conformance. I show my class Bohemian Rhapsody.
Yeah?
Yeah, I like that film. Robbie did his thing. I'm happy for him.
You worked with him twice.
What?
You worked with him twice.
Yeah. He's a great guy, great actor. We showed all 10 episodes, upcoming second season of She's Gotta
Have It.
Yeah, they got it.
How do they respond to the movie? Do you show them She's Gotta Have It, your film?
Oh, they've seen it before.
Okay, because I just wonder now, because that's, I've told you this before. I feel like it's a film that, we're talking about things that predict the film. It's about a woman in possession of her sexual power. Mm-hmm. Nobody's making movies like that. They're not making movies like that now, as a matter of fact. And also, somebody who understood the power of language and knew who she was and used language. I mean, it's so interesting to look back at your films and see how, in so many ways, you understood something early on. I mean, was that conscious for you, do you think? Or did you just arrive at that?
Yes. You could, let's, I'm not trying to pat myself in the back as I pat myself on the back. Do the right thing. I wrote that script in 88. Gentrification, global warming. I mean, the guys in the corner were talking about the ice polar cap melting. I wrote that in 88. You know, look at Bed-Stuy where we shot the film. It's totally gentrified now. Look at the last two words of School Days said by Lawrence Fishburne. Wake up. The first words said by Samuel Jackson for the following film, Do the Right Thing, Wake up. So, you know, people talking about being woke. You got to wake up first to get woke.
I'm sorry to say this as he laughs himself away, but we're out of time. You have to come back and do the show again, please.
No problem.
It's always a pleasure to see you.
Always.
My guest who has the best watch collection of any director I know is Spike Lee. His new film is Black Klansman. My recording engineer here on NPR West is Marcia Caldwell. The show is mixed by Kat Yor. It's edited by Blake Veit. I'm just a black guy from Detroit. It's The Treatment.
Day 12.
Catch up on past episodes of The Treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.